Bruce Pepich, Executive Director and Curator of Collections at the Racine Art Museum. What a delight, what a pleasure to come here and experience firsthand the museum.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here.
And it really isn't a museum.
It's more like a storefront operation or an art center. It's not musty in any way. It's a very lively place. We're trying to provide opportunities for artists to show their work and to build their careers, but also it's a place where you connect artists through their work to the public, and we want the public to be as creative as possible because it makes people better citizens, it makes them better problem solvers, it makes them better and more employable, keeps kids in school.
Seems to me you have two primary missions. One is finding ways to attract the people to come in here and experience it. The other is outreach, bringing the art to the people. And I know you do that in different ways.
It is. Part of our role here is to perform a tourism function by bringing cultural tourists, people who travel to learn, into the community. Also to create a sense of vitality for the downtown so that people who live here find this to be a better place in which to live, visit, and work. And then also we go out to the kids in classrooms and schools. We visit every second grade classroom. Every fourth grade classroom comes to the museum for a tour in our large public school system. So again, you're reaching broad areas. We have a 38% minority population in the city itself. 39% of our participants in our education programs are minority people. So it's great to know that we're bringing everyone in. I think that visual art has a way of crossing class and race barriers and economic barriers and giving young people a sense of potential for the future.
Bruce, give us some tangible specifics.
Well, the museum's collection, we have lots of artwork in craft media, which means we collect clay, fiber, glass, metal, wood, polymer, also functional objects in those media, and then sculptural works. So you may come around a corner and find a case full of teapots that are made by artists, or bowls, or maybe a wall hanging, or clothing that's wearable that's designed by artists and made in a studio. Functional jewelry, and then also pieces that hang on the wall. It's constantly welcoming people, but also changing their perceptions of what these materials can be in the employment to make artwork and how they can be used. And that's very exciting, I think, for most visitors. It's materials that they're familiar with from their daily life and their family's history, because everybody has family members that have made quilts or knit or crochet or hand paint china. The other thing we do is we go out a great deal throughout the community. We have a museum van. We go to special events in the community with hands-on projects, street fairs, street festivals, company picnics, things like that, where you can really find groups of people together and take the artwork to them. We visit each of the second graders in their classrooms, and then 2 years later, all the fourth graders come to the museum for a guided tour and a hands-on project where they get to work in the material they see on display that the adults are using. And frequently, that's a medium that they haven't worked on in school yet, so they get an introduction to something special. We also have a very active volunteer program for teenagers and college-age students, so we're working with interns, intern programs, and also young people who are providing volunteer services here, and we're providing that kind of connection to those young adults as they're aging and getting more interested in what they want to do as they get into college.
Your artwork that you showcase here obviously rotates, but you have areas that you specialize in, and I'm presuming that fiber art is a specialty here.
We have one of the largest contemporary handmade basket collections in the country, that we're known for that. We have a very large 600-piece contemporary, primarily ceramic teapot collection of teapots made by artists. The museum has a large jewelry collection, over 1,000 pieces. These are permanent collections that we own. Now, all this material is not on display at one time because a lot of the craft media, you have to be careful about exposure to daylight. Fibers, wood, paper, those things can fade easily, so we have to be careful. We rotate those. We change all of our shows twice a year. Most of them come from the collection, and we're constantly bringing things in and out and changing it around. You may come here three times in a six-year period, and you might see one of the same pieces three times, but it will be in three different exhibitions, and you'll see it in three different contexts, which will give you different interpretations of the work, and I think that's important because the work doesn't change between visits, but you do, and you'll see different things in those objects.
Talk to us a little bit more about your philosophy and making art relevant to the people, not to the other artists?
Well, I think we're the facilitator of the conversation that takes place between the artist and the public via the artwork. And we're very much against the idea of art being snooty, or this idea that, well, if you're not an insider, you're not welcome to be part of it. Yes, if the more you know, the more you will enjoy of it, but it doesn't mean that you can't walk in the door and find something pleasurable and inspiring in all the things that we have here. And if you take the time to learn a little bit more, that experience can be made richer. But the way I feel about this is we're at a time in our development as humans that you can have a good meal, you can have a good glass of wine, you should be exposed to great works of art, because they're all the things that make life richer and more meaningful. And it's something that we can share with everyone. We have free admission first Friday of the month. We're open till 9 o'clock at night on those evenings. We'll have hundreds of people come in on that day to experience what's on display. Our Worcester Museum campus, which is our second location, that's free all the time.
There are different functions down there. Tell us about what takes place there that doesn't happen here downtown.
The Worcester campus is our original mothership, as we say. That opened up in 1941. We do shows there for local and regional artists, but it is our visual education center. We host studio classes for children and adults. We have hands-on projects there. RAM, 2 miles away in the downtown, is where we show artists with national and international reputations, and we do some hands-on education programs here during weekends and special event time, but this is really where we show the bulk of the exhibitions. We have 12,000 square feet as opposed to 2,000 square feet of exhibition area, so this is really about putting the public in connection with the artwork and connecting them together.
Let's flip back to your educational component. And in what ways do you teach the kids and they come to learn in accessibility? Are they charged a fee? How do they pay for it? What if they are low income?
The public school programs that we conduct, and those are across the board, a wide range of people from different economic portions of the community, those are all free. Those are provided free to the public schools, and we reach a couple thousand children a year at each grade level, I'm estimating. The studio classes, we take children as young as 2 years old in some of those. If they're not with a parent or a grandparent, they have to be 4 and preferably body trained, or at least no one to ask to leave.
Definitely starting them young.
Yeah, yeah. There can be a case for starting them too young, I guess. Those classes have a reasonable fee, but we also have scholarships available that people can apply for. And then when we're doing programs downtown on First Fridays, we have a 4-hour period each First Friday where families can come and participate for free in a hands-on project. And it's always tied into one of the exhibits at RAM that's going on at that time. So if it's a jewelry show, there'll be a jewelry project, and you can leave having made something to wear. And, you know, when we first started doing these, I think we thought the parents would sit with Johnny or Mary and make the piece together. And frankly, what happens is the child makes a work, and the mother makes a work, and the father makes a work at the same time. And we love that they're all so invested in this idea, and that they're working together and separately as well, and kind of, you know, talking to each other while the process is going on. And that, to me, it brings families together. It just helps connect this to people's daily lives and makes them understand how important this can be to your daily life.
Talk to us philosophically. It's one thing, again, for somebody that already has a sensitivity and an awareness and appreciation for art and the arts to come and savor it. But again, it's cloistered away. So in what ways is art an essential ingredient in the fabric of society and culture?
Well, I try to see that all of our education programs are fairly practical in the sense that the introductory courses, we want people to be able to produce something that makes them feel good about the time they've put into this. Then if you go on to upper level courses, it's more self-directed and you do critiques and so forth, and you don't expect to finish that landscape in one sitting. From the standpoint of the hands-on projects, those are designed to teach a quick technical thing to the attendee. Frequently, it's with a recycled everyday material from around the house. So again, that makes a connection for them that it doesn't just save the museum budget money from expensive art materials, but the idea is to have people see that there are things around the house, beautiful packaging that we throw away, wonderful plastic materials that we discard. You can actually do something aesthetic with them. It's a dual lesson, learning to recycle and also learning to make something beautiful out of trash. And that's a great thing for children in particular because they're so tuned into this.
Fascinating. Making their environment expanded, yeah.
Trash into treasure, you know. but again, a lot of the artists are looking at this. They're looking for new avenues to explore, new materials to put together that haven't been put together before. There's whole schools of jewelers, for example, that have said, the value in my jewelry should not be in how big of a stone I'm using or how much gold I'm using. It should be based on the idea I'm putting behind my work, the aesthetic message I'm trying to communicate, and the way I execute that message, and the communication that exists between my work and the viewer. And that's a different way of looking at it.
Going back in time, kind of off subject, but not really from a societal standpoint, I understand that you have some WPA artwork here. Talk to us about that. That's fascinating.
The museum's original director, who came here to open the museum up in 1941, had run the Michigan State WPA program, and his name was Sylvester Gerry. And the Wustoms, who had set the museum up, were not art collectors. They just wanted an art center set up in their name to serve the community. And that's not a just thing, that's a wonderful gift to give. But through his contacts, within the first 2 years the museum was open, he had a gift of 300 works created by artists in the New York City WPA program and also in the state of Wisconsin Federal Art Program come to the community. So we have both urban images and rural scenes, primarily works on paper, watercolors, prints, drawings, and photographs. We have a large WPA photograph collection.
And that's your permanent collection, and you rotate that to put on display.
Right, and we have probably four generations now of, for example, Midwestern artists who studied or have descended from people who studied from those artists after the Depression was over and after World War II was over. And it's interesting also to trace how those aesthetic messages and teachings can go from one generation through maybe three generations down the road and still be strong. It's also sort of like a way of looking at, say, how you draw, or an aesthetic that is carried on.
Style and perspective.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I still think the Midwest has a great respect for regionalism, but even if that's used to create surrealistic works of art, we have a lot of emphasis on very specific drawing techniques and being based in basics before you go on to more abstract expressions.
Artists are the modern incarnation of the caveman that put their hand mark on the wall.
I always say they're the shaman for all of our tribal groups, because they are the magicians. Artists can take a lump of clay or a piece of white paper, basically nothing, and turn it into something that, if it isn't financially valuable, is at least culturally valuable. And that's a true gift, and it is magic.
Then on another level, you have the artist as a recordist of social events. I think of Picasso and the mm-hmm. Spanish War, Guernica, you know. I mean, that left its mark forever in it.
Well, and even though there were photographers photographing the Spanish Civil War, there's nothing quite like experiencing the Spanish Civil War when you're standing looking at Guernica and you're thinking about the way that violence and that transgression against people was presented. It's fascinating to me how people are so tied into the WPA pieces, because so much of it is representational recording of the way people lived in the cities and on the farms, and they come in and they just click into it automatically, and it is such an open door to that period in time that speaks differently than a photograph does.
You've been blessed to have spent hours looking at those works of art in a variety of media. I can tell, I know they spoke to you. Mm-hmm. What did you learn? What did they say to you?
Well, it talks to me a lot about how so many individuals were impacted by the Great Depression. You know, we've just gone through the second biggest economic downturn, and you think about unemployment being 25%. You know, we were crying at 6 and 7% unemployment levels, maybe 10% in some areas. But to think that this country had 25% unemployment, to think about everyone in the neighborhood losing their home, nobody knowing when their next big meal was going to come from, the fact that in Wisconsin, the WPA handicraft program in Milwaukee would rebind the school books in the summer. You know, they weren't buying new textbooks. There was no money for that. So there are the impact that this had on every individual American at that time is one of the things I think that is communicated to me so much. And
I want to get in your brain. I mean, you looked at these works of art and they spoke to you. Can you think of an example of a painting or a photo that you saw how this artist saw his world in a distinctive way, time and place, contexture?
There's one print in the collection called Machine Fodder, and it's basically this sort of stylized image of workers being marching towards the blast furnace, you know, and you realize that even the people who had jobs, who were darn lucky to have a job at the time, were really working hard. You know, you're talking pre-OSHA regulations. And I often think, you know, I'm of that era of people who, when we were children, were often told stories around the dinner table about the Great Depression, and where it was often used as, you know, a teaching tool, shall we say, maybe more a lecture point about, you know, you weren't even born during the Depression, you don't know what this was like. And we talk about ourselves being the children of Depression babies and how it changed the way you looked at the prosperity that came to this country in the 1950s after the Second World War, and how that must have been. It makes me constantly think about my parents and their generation and what they went through, and the great disparity between deprivation and also plenty at the same time in maybe a 20-year period. It must have been really something to adjust to, and the art makes you think about that in ways that a lecture from your father wouldn't.
Very powerful. Bruce Pepich, Executive Director and Curator of Collections at the Racine Art Museum. What a pleasure to visit with you.
It's great to have you here. Thank you.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Racine, Wisconsin.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
It was a large room full of people, all kinds, and they had all arrived at the same building at more or less the same time, and they were all free, and they were all asking themselves the same questions.